This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Johnny Greenwood, was nominated for an Oscar last Tuesday for his original score for the film The Power of the Dog. In a way, he owes this part of his career to screenwriter and director Paul Thomas Anderson. When Greenwood was primarily known as the lead guitarist and keyboardist for the band Radiohead, Anderson asked Greenwood to write the score for his film There Will Be Blood. It was an unexpected turn for Greenwood, but he was immediately noticed. The score was described in Rolling Stone as a sonic explosion that reinvented what film music could be. Greenwood wrote scores for Anderson's subsequent films, including Phantom Thread and The Master, which opened like this. That's a pretty great way to start a film. Greenwood also writes a lot of film music that's more avant-garde, but some of the avant-garde music is influenced by his love of Baroque. He studied classical music when he was young, played in a youth orchestra, and has been a composer in residence at the BBC Concert Orchestra. Now you can hear his music in three very different new movies: Anderson's Licorice Pizza, which is set in the 70s, Spencer, starring Kristen Stewart as Princess Diana, and The Power of the Dog, which is set in Montana in 1925. In the beginning of The Power of the Dog, two brothers who own a large cattle ranch are herding the cattle to market. This is the music we hear. Johnny Greenwood, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your music. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. So that music that we just heard from The Power of the Dog, it starts like it's going to be very Western-ish, but not quite. And then there's other potentially menacing music intruding on it. It's a buzzy, ominous-sounding melody interfering with this Western-ish kind of sound. So, and it lets you know that this isn't going to be a conventional Western, even though they're herding cattle. And it also lets you know that bad things are going to be interfering. What's happening musically? What are you doing musically?
I think Westerns have a traditional sound, which is big sweeping strings and sort of Copland-style harmonies, which are not only beyond me, but wouldn't have really suited the darkness of the film, I think. So the approach to this was originally to try and write music for banjo and string quartet, because I'm a big believer that the banjo can be a great, dark, sinister instrument. I mean, I grew up listening to things like the Violent Femmes, and they managed to do that sort of country death song style, you know, banjo as you know, the opposite of the Steve Martin, you know, right. routine about how banjos just make you smile, which is true, and you know, and all that stuff is wonderful music. But there's also a dark side, I think, to that kind of music. Anyway, I persuaded her to let me try and write something for banjo and string quartet, and it was awful, as you might imagine, and just sounded wrong in every way. So on the rebound from that, I just started trying to play my cello like it was a banjo, so doing the rolling finger picking thing on a cello instead.
So with the strings that kind of interfere with that plucked cello sound, making the sound even more unconventional, what did you do to get that kind of menacing sound from violins or violins and violas?
So I had them play with no vibrato, and you know, that's a really beautiful effect in a way. I think the danger with writing music not on paper and relying on computers and demos is that you start to get used to how some string sounds and then just look to replicate that. Whereas the variety of colour that, you know, one player can make with a string instrument is already quite mind-blowing. And just the combination a whole ensemble and all the directions it can go, it's really exciting and daunting. And it's easily my favorite day of the year is when the string players turn up for an afternoon.
Do you want the strings to be perfectly tuned, or do you want them to be just slightly off?
Okay. Yes. I wrote one cue for the Lynn Ramsey film, You're Never Really Here. We're asking them to have half the players tuned a quarter tone flat, so just a little bit out of tune, but all as out of tune as one another, if you see what I mean. But because they're playing with their ears, it's very hard to do. So they're still making their fingers go to where their ear wants to hear the right note. So even though it was difficult to do and they were sort of weren't doing it properly, it was one of those things where you just end up being even more impressed by what they can do and how they're playing and thinking and making these sounds. So yeah, I get all, you know, all very excited and fanboy about string players. I mean, whenever I see somebody, you know, walking into Abbey Road and they're carrying their cello and going to do a string session, I just know how many hours and days of their life they've spent rehearsing, you know, every day for 4 hours, 3, 4, 5 hours. And then you get to hear the results of that. And it's very daunting. And I admire the musicians who give their life to that, really.
You started writing film scores because Paul Thomas Anderson asked you to write music for There Will Be Blood. What was your first reaction when he asked you to do something you'd never done before? Had you ever thought about doing film scores?
No, I hadn't. My reaction when Paul asked me was just excitement that I was going to get access to musicians and be able to write music for someone. And the fact that it was for a film, I didn't really, up until that time, pay that much attention to film music, really. And I just thought, this is going to be a bit like being in a band with somebody, except I'm in a band with Paul and the people who are making this film and going to be contributing music to it. And as a way to disassociate from it, I suppose, and feel like it's not really to do with me. And when I started thinking like that, I just found it really enjoyable and fun to throw lots of music in his direction.
Do you find it helpful to know that I have to write music that fits this mood or that fits this scene? And there's a purpose that defines what the music has to be. Is that helpful in digging out, you know, music from your brain to know what it's for?
It is, but I mean, there's a few cues in Phantom Thread that were written specifically for the scene they're in, but they're the minority, really. It's usually more a case of writing music about the characters or the scenery or the story itself. Like in There Will Be Blood, I remember being really taken with the story of HW and this sort of abandoned boy being taken. And I enjoyed writing quite a lot of, I suppose, quite sentimental music for that. And, you know, I enjoyed that easily as much as writing the more atonal and stranger, you know, relatively stranger orchestrations and things. And I try and avoid things like click tracks. So quite often the players are just being asked to play 2 or 3 minutes of music and the poor editor or director have to just, you know, put up with something that might not fit to picture or even move the picture around so it fits the music. But this is partly from just a trying to avoid computers as being the arbiter in how music is played and how, you know, how tempos are conducted. And we'll just ask the players to play something, you know, in 3 or 4 different tempos and then do the work in the edit into making things work with the film itself.
When you write for a movie, are you seeing the footage of the scene you're writing for before you compose it, or are you composing it before it's even shot?
Usually a lot of it gets written when I see the first test footage or just see early footage of, like with Jane Campion's film, it was seeing all of the footage of New Zealand that was standing in for Montana and just seeing the colours of the film and understanding the script and the characters. And that's, I mean, that's already lots of really, you know, fertile ground to start writing music. And I'd rather write twice as much music as needed and just keep going rather than panic about, you know, dropping the level of the music at the right place, so a line of dialogue can be fitted in exactly in the right second. And so I'm very indulged in that way, in that I'm allowed to start at work very early while films are being, you know, shot, or even before.
You started studying classical music when you were a child. How did you go in that direction? Was it through school? Were you assigned an instrument? Did your parents listen to classical music?
No, there was never really music playing in the house other than from my older sister, Susan. But in terms of classical stuff, I think it was just because I was given a plastic recorder when I was six as a surprise present. And then I had 5 years where I was at a primary school where I was told that no one was allowed to play the recorder until they were 11. And this just became this instrument of total, you know, fascination and frustration. It's like, why can't I? I just couldn't wait to start. So I think it was just that old story of, you know, of denial, making something seem just, you know, all the more delicious. And once I started playing recorder, I kept at it seriously till I was 18. You know, I still play it now.
Okay, a recorder is a wind instrument, but you had a plastic one. Now, I had a plastic one in sixth grade because we all had to play ensemble plastic recorders, which were known as flutophones. And, you know, the ones we had, I don't know about yours, but the ones we had, it was as if a wooden recorder mated with a kazoo and came up with this kind of annoying sound that was only heightened when there were 30 of them playing ensemble. So, was yours a flutophone or a recorder? Like, how did it sound?
I mean, I'm sure it sounded gruesome, but I was impressed with myself enough to sit in my room playing it all day. But yeah, it was just a Baroque style recorder made of creamy yellow plastic by the Hohner Corporation in 1979 or whatever it was.
So before you were with Radiohead, my understanding is you were in a band with Tom York's younger brother. Tom York is the lead singer, songwriter from Radiohead. So your older brother was in a band with Tom York. You were in a band with Tom York's younger brother. Do I have that right?
You do. That's right.
So how did you end up playing with Tom York and forming Radiohead?
Well, they had a keyboard player who, it's Tom's band, had a keyboard player, which I think they didn't get on with because he played his keyboard so loud. And so when I got the chance to play with them, the first thing I did was make sure my keyboard was turned off when I was playing. And I must have done months of rehearsals with them with this keyboard that was just, they didn't know that I'd already turned it off and was just, they made quite a racket, quite a noise. It was all guitars and distortion. And so I would pretend to play for weeks on end. And Tom would say, I can't quite hit what you're doing, but I think you're adding a really interesting texture that, because I can tell when you're not playing. And I'm thinking, no, you can't, because I'm really not playing. And I'd go home in the evening and work out how to actually play chords. And cautiously over the next few months, I would start turning this keyboard up. And that's how I started, started in with Radiohead.
Wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand this correctly. So the first period that you were playing with Radiohead, you turned off the keyboard.
Yeah.
And so you were
sure,
fingering the keys, but no sound was being emitted because this is an electric keyboard. So
exactly.
Nothing was coming out and nobody noticed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were kind of noisy garage band, I suppose, in a small rehearsal room. And I remember the first few songs when I did start playing melodies and Tom liked it and it was very exciting.
So since you've had a foot in classical music and in rock for so long and have been important in both worlds, I think the division has melted away for a lot of classical performers, but not so much for other people because so many people don't listen to classical music at all anymore. It's just not... I think it's become more and more of a niche, with the exception of film scores. This is one of the great things about film scores, is that it brings a different kind of music, often, into people who otherwise wouldn't hear it.
I think streaming has been quite bad for classical music, because if you are keen to find out more about classical music, you might have heard that the Beethoven Violin Concerto is a great piece of music. So you go on to Spotify or whatever, and when you search for it, you're presented with 500 recordings. And it's just, I think it's just a bit of a sort of daunting and off-putting thing. There's very little curation and very little... And plus you're made to feel like it's just, you know, that it's somehow beyond you. And it's, which is really sad, I think. I do sort of mourn the days when you used to listen to a record hundreds of times and get everything you could out of it. And I'm the same. I'll listen to a Miles Davis record on Spotify. And then rather than play it again, I'll move on to the next one. And there's just none of that sort of obsession. And I think classical music especially suffers with that, because if you can, you know, live with the same piece of classical music for a few weeks, you know, it'll reveal itself to you. But it's about having the patience to do that.
Johnny Greenwood, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for your music. And I don't know if you care very much about awards, but I wish you good luck in award season.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry.
Johnny Greenwood's score for The Power of the Dog was just nominated for an Oscar. He's Radiohead's lead guitarist and keyboardist. When you think of the acting technique known as the method, you may think of Raging Bull and how Robert De Niro gained 60 pounds to play boxer Jake LaMotta. You may think of actors who stay in character even while they're not performing. Or, as my guest Isaac Butler puts it, we tend to think of the method as some goofy hocus-pocus relied on by actors, particularly the more self-important ones, in order to do their job. Or, as someone he met once put it, it's remembering the most traumatic thing that ever happened to you in order to make yourself cry. But the method is much, much more, Butler says. In his new book, The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act, he describes the history of the method from the series of techniques created in the early 1900s by the Russian director Konstantin Stanislavski, through the American adaptation created by the group Theater and the Actor Studio, and the actors who brought those techniques to their work on stage and screen. It's also the story of how acting was influenced by war, social change, and personal and aesthetic battles. Isaac Butler also co-wrote the book The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. He's also a theater director, teaches theater history and performance at the New School, co-hosts the Slate podcast Working about the creative process, and is a cultural critic whose writing frequently appears in Slate. Isaac Butler, welcome to Fresh Air. As someone who frequently interviews actors, I really enjoyed and appreciated reading your book. Let's start with an example of a performance that you think embodies the method.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. You know, when I think about the method, I think of a performance like Al Pacino's in the first Godfather film, in that, you know, a lot of that role is communicated non-verbally through you watching the character think. The character is often feeling emotions in a very intense way, but not letting them out, but also allowing you to see that they are feeling them. You know, there's a certain amount of mystery to the character and idiosyncrasy. It feels like a real person in all of their complexity, not like a type or a stock role or anything like that. And, you know, Al Pacino just seems really alive in the moment and really present in that role at all times. So to me, that's an example of the kind of performances that the method helped usher to the fore over the course of the 20th century.
I forget who it was, but one of the method directors or teachers said, you know, let someone else take the part with a lot of dialogue. You'd take the part where you're just like thinking and reacting.
Yeah, absolutely. That was Kazan. You know, when Aaliyah Kazan briefly was trying to be a film actor, you know, he really learned from the other actors on set that part of what you do is you let everyone else say all the lines, that the camera can really read your mind and it can really see your thoughts on your face. So part of the thing that you do is you just think and the camera will see what you're thinking.
there's different approaches to the method, but one of them really emphasizes digging into your own emotional history, your emotional memories, to use those to get into your character. And you were practicing that when you were in college and you had a role, and you had been a professional child actor. And you write in the introduction to your book that through this process of mining your own emotional memories, you retreated too far into your personal darkness. Can you describe how that happened? Because I'd really like to understand how, like, psychologically upsetting it can be to take this approach to plumbing your own emotional depth.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. It was over two decades ago, but I still remember it really vividly. The play was Talk Radio, which is by Eric Bogosian, and he wrote it for himself to play the lead character, who's this kind of like shock jock, right? And over the course of the 90-minute play, that the actor playing that part, you are chain smoking and you're talking to people who are calling into the radio. And then at the end of 90 minutes on stage, you have a nervous breakdown, you know, live on the air. That's the arc of the play. And this was a college production. It was student directors who, you know, of course, didn't really know what they were doing, and neither did any of the rest of us. And but we probably had 2 or 3 weeks of rehearsal. And, you know, the character I was playing was older than me, had a lot more life experience, and they're having their nervous breakdown based on whatever's the matter with them. And the only way I knew how to find a connection to them was to go deep into the things that I thought were wrong with me, and, you know, my own depression at being, you know, newly in college, and my own loneliness and my own feelings of inadequacy and guilt and all sorts of other things. And so I really spent a lot of time thinking through those things and finding them and finding images or sensory ideas associated with them so I could kind of trigger them. And so I was doing that on stage and at the same time chain smoking real cigarettes for 90 minutes. And so, you know, I would end every performance feeling completely wrung out emotionally and physically ill simultaneously. And so what I would have to do at the end of the show is I would go back to my dorm room and I would just stare at a blank wall until I kind of like my stomach settled down and I felt my humanity return. And, you know, that show only performed 3 or 4 times. And I just remember at the end of it, saying to myself, I am not tough enough to keep doing this again and again and again for part after part. I can't do this. And that was the last moment in my life that I really considered pursuing a career as an actor. I very quickly switched to focusing on directing and then eventually to writing, which led to the book that we're talking about today.
So is this one of the fundamental aesthetic battles in acting, whether you have to kind of damage yourself in order to play a role?
Certainly one of the fundamental aesthetic battles in acting is whether the actor should be on some level really experiencing what the character is experiencing while they're on stage or on screen. And, you know, for hundreds of years, the consensus was, no, they absolutely should not do that. That is in poor taste. You know, they can't really play the part if they're doing that. They can't control themselves, et cetera, and so forth. But, you know, starting with Konstantin Stanislavski and then with the people who followed in his footsteps, we as a culture changed our mind about that. And we began to prize things like vulnerability and risk and on the actor's part and the sense that they are really on some level really doing what the character is doing, not to such an extent that they lose all sense of themselves, because that truly would be madness, but that something real is at stake in those performances.
So let's talk about the roots of the method. The method is an American version of the acting techniques that were codified by Konstantin Stanislavski, the Russian director who co-founded the Moscow Art Theater in the 1890s. He started codifying his approach in 1906. He called it the system. Can you describe some of the basic tenets of the system?
Sure. The system flows from a couple of really simple core ideas. One of them has to do with the necessity of the actor experiencing, is the word that they use. Experiencing is a rough translation of a Russian word, perezhivanie, and it means just that moment where the actor is so into the imagined reality of the character that to some extent they're really feeling and experiencing what the character is going through. And some of its other sort of core ideas are that the actor actor is their own material. They're kind of both the painter and the paint, that a role should be divided up into its component parts, which he called bits. He was very into physical relaxation and the actor using the powers of concentration and attention to forget the audience was there and to try to kind of live again within the imagined reality of the play and of the character. One of the things that he was also very interested in, which would become particularly notorious in the United States, was this idea of affective memory. And affective memory is essentially triggering a strong emotional state that you might need to play the character through using your own memories of when you have experienced that emotion.
He also had a principle that acting should be guided by actions, by things that you wanted or needed, demands that you had. And you give the example of if you're thirsty, then you want a glass of water.
Yes. Yeah. Hopefully in most plays, it's more high stakes than just being thirsty, right? But yes, actually, one of his ideas that goes on to be really the cornerstone of a lot of American acting and directing and script analysis is that characters are always wanting something and they're always doing something in pursuit of the thing that they want. And those wants and the things they're doing, there's a whole lot of different names for them. The task, the problem, the objective, the action. But whatever you call it, the core idea is that I, as a character, have something that I need, something that I want, and that I'm going to do things, which is often language is the thing that I'm doing, but I'm going to do something to accomplish that end.
Stanislavski also emphasized the importance of rehearsals, and he was really, really strict about them. And he'd have people rehearse like over and over and over and over again until they'd get angry with him.
Yeah, absolutely. That predates the system, really. That comes from the very start of his career. You know, he was rebelling against a status quo in Russia where plays weren't really rehearsed that much. They were rehearsed like 9 times, maybe. The dress rehearsal was a relatively new idea. And so he was rebelling against that by saying, no, the whole point of rehearsal is that we're going to do this over and over again. The actors and the director are going to have a unified vision of what the play is trying to do. And they're all going to kind of sublimate themselves to that unified vision. And we're going to do it over and over and over again until we get it right. That becomes particularly extreme once he starts using his rehearsal periods to experiment with developing the system. And probably his production of Hamlet rehearses for something like 3 years, you know, so eventually it gets really, really out of control. And there are times where he rehearses things for 14 months and the play is no better off than it was at the beginning. So those two ideas, one that predates the system and one that comes from the system, kind of intersect in ways that eventually cause him a huge number of problems.
Let's look at Marlon Brando, because his breakthrough roles are in A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. And, you know, both of them, he's working class. He's not speaking with that almost British formal proper way of speaking. Did he consider himself a method actor? Because he's always held up as an example of the method.
I'm so glad you asked me that, because Marlon Brando absolutely did not consider himself a method actor. Most importantly, because by the time he's emerging in the 50s, the method is really Lee Strasberg. They're synonymous, you know, and Marlon Brando was a discovery and protege and close friend of Stella Adler's. It's actually Stella Adler who taught him how to act. And he would say in interviews, you know, Lee Strasberg never taught me anything. It was all Stella Adler and Elia Kazan. And so, you know, he was very offended by what he saw as the inappropriate claiming of his work for the method. At the same time, his performances in those two movies are so unbelievably influential for the generations of male American actors who came afterwards, that, you know, they establish, if you want to think of the method as a style, that style would absolutely not exist without Marlon Brando.
How would you define that style?
That's the $64,000 question, right? So part of that style has to do with speaking colloquially is a big part of that style. A lot of it has to do with an emphasis on subtext, an emphasis on what the character is not saying, not allowing to be voiced, on the restraint of emotion, and then contrasting that kind of with huge emotional displays when necessary. There's that colloquialism of speech also extends to the body and to movement. It feels very much like an everyday person. It often involves throwing away lines instead of making sure you can clearly understand all of them. Often it is marked by, and this is particularly because Alia Kazan was really into this, it's often marked by an extensive use of props on set and the use of the actor's hands and the objects they fiddle with to reveal kind of what's going on with the character.
Doesn't that eventually come to be seen as bits of business that you should be cutting out?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there are reviews of Kazan's later stage work on Broadway where sometimes the reviewers are kind of rolling their eyes at it. And it's like, of course, here comes Kazan with all his stage business again. You know, it's absolutely true that as with any number of other movements in art, that the ideas that seem fresh because they flow out of the, I guess, authentic point of view of an individual, they become codified and then they become stylistic tricks and then they become cliches. And that happens all over the place, whether we're talking about paint dripping on canvas or, you know, the way Marlon Brando does stage business, or it becomes Brad Pitt eating sunflower seeds in every movie or whatever, you know. So there is a way in which these become diluted and then they can become a kind of cliche.
I want to ask you something else about Brando. You write about how on stage in Streetcar Named Desire, he would give like a different performance every night. I mean, he'd say the right lines, but his way of delivering them would be different. And it really threw off his co-star, Jessica Tandy, and she just really was furious with him. So do you see both sides of that?
I absolutely see both sides of that debate. And she was not the only one, although she was the one who called him a psychopathic bastard. So she definitely was the most colorful about it. Carl Malden, who worked with Brando many times, and I don't think they were friends, but it's not like Malden hated Brando. You know, there was one point in rehearsals for Streetcar when he got into a screaming match with Brando because he said, you know, your pauses are so unpredictable. I can't ever get my teeth into this scene and figure out what the rhythm is. It is absolutely a professional actor's job to do their role on stage in such a way that enables the best of your colleagues. You know, that's absolutely part of the job. And traditionally, and this is still true today, one of the ways you do that is to set your performance, is to freeze the performance. You know, part of what the method and the system are trying to help you do is create the illusion of spontaneity within a fixed performance. And Brando did not do that. Brando was a kind of mercurial trickster and sometimes could be very, very selfish, it seems to me. And so he would just do whatever he was going to do. He would change the timing of lines. Sometimes he would actually change the lines or throw the lines away, or you couldn't hear your cue because he had mumbled it or whatever. And Jessica Tandy, who's a classically trained British actor, was really ticked at him about it with some justification. And she didn't have a lot of allies in that fight because Alia Kazan and Tennessee Williams just couldn't get past what a brilliant job Brando was doing. And it wasn't only them. Hume Cronyn, her husband, who advocated for her to get the part, he's really the reason why she was cast as Blanche in the first place. Hume Cronyn could see that Brando was sort of overpowering her all the time. And so it was a really, really difficult struggle for her. And eventually Brando tried to apologize to her and it didn't go very well. And it led to this really extraordinary exchange of letters, which I discuss in my book, where he tries to apologize for how difficult he was to work with. And she kind of gives him what for and says, look, if you want to be a good actor who's taken seriously and a leader of your profession for the rest of your life, because you are good enough that you could do that, you need to shape up and you need to be reliable and you need to act in the author's style, not yours.
Let's talk about The Godfather, because in terms of acting techniques, it's such a fascinating film. It's a wonderful film in every way, but let's look at how the method figures into The Godfather. So you've got De Niro, who studied with Stella Adler. You've got Pacino, who studied with her rival, Lee Strasberg. And then in Godfather 2, you've got Lee Strasberg himself playing Hyman Roth.
Yeah.
So, what do you see, when you look at that film, what do you see in terms of conflicting styles and, you know, background rivalries? What were you able to learn about that from researching the book?
Well, you know, another thing I should say is that you've also got Sanford Meisner, who's sort of the third rival in there as well, because Diane Keaton and Robert Duvall and James Caan all studied with him. And so part of what I see in that actually is that because in some ways the end goal of Meisner, Adler, and Strasberg is the same, and it's that shared end goal with Stanislavski of experiencing, you know, of that kind of absolute truth, you can see how all these different paths can lead to a fairly similar or compatible place. The acting in those movies is magnificent. It is really incredible what they do as an ensemble. And you also see little moments that kind of highlight what each of those teachers are best at. So I think, for example, the sequence where Al Pacino is at the restaurant considering whether or not to commit murder for the first time. This is about halfway through the first Godfather film. And he gets, you know, he gets the gun from the tank behind the toilet, and he's going through this whole sort of tortured consideration of whether he's actually going to go through with this act, and how is he going to do it? But he never says that. There's no lines where he says it. You know, it's all in his body and it's all in his face. And it's almost like you can read his thoughts in the subtext of the character. That is Lee Strasberg's techniques at its best. Then later in the film, when Diane Keaton is confronting Al Pacino, when Kay is confronting Michael about whether or not he had his brother-in-law killed, and he's saying over and over and over again, don't ask me about my business, Kay. Don't ask me about my business, Kay. And they're sort of provoking each other back and forth, repeating these same lines over and over and over again. That, to me, is the amazing messiness and spontaneity that Sanford Meisner really taught his students. And he often taught them that through an exercise that involved repeating lines back and forth to one another. And then when you get to the second film and you have De Niro as the young Vito Corleone, De Niro also studied with Stella Adler, and you get this sort of heavily research-driven process where he's really trying to feel not only like this character, but like an Italian immigrant of the early 20th century. And what would that person look like? How would they inhabit the space? What would their accent be like? How would they talk? You know, he has that really weird, scratchy voice in that movie. And all of that comes from this kind of in-depth research that he would do. So you really see these pupils bring the best of what those various teachers have to offer in a way that I find just totally thrilling.
I love Lee Strasberg's performance as Hyman Roth, who's based on Meyer Lansky. I love when he offers everybody tuna fish sandwiches. But
yes.
And anyways, I wonder what it was like to have him as a working actor, since he was like the leading acting teacher of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because at that point, he was incredibly famous as an acting teacher, and he was making a lot of money as an acting teacher. He did not need to go act in this movie. Really, he didn't. And he hadn't acted in decades, and he had never acted on screen. He was a stage actor briefly. But Al Pacino really wanted him for that part. But by the time Strasberg agreed to do the movie was already being shot. I mean, he flew out to be on set almost immediately after signing his contract. So he did not have a lot of preparation time. And one of the reasons why he wanted to do the role was that he wanted to see what it was like to apply his techniques to film and to see, you know, what he could learn about it. In the end result, what you see is this really fascinatingly strange performance, in part because Strasberg was in real life a fascinatingly strange person. And what you also see is how much he and Al Pacino love each other in real life.
So getting to another De Niro role, in Raging Bull, De Niro plays the boxer Jake LaMotta. And, you know, later in LaMotta's life, after he's retired, he puts on a lot of weight. And De Niro gained like 60 pounds for the role. And you write about all the really bad health effects gaining 60 pounds in a rapid amount of time affected De Niro. I don't remember exactly what health problems he developed.
I mean, you know, when you hear oh, well, you know, for this part, you're going to have to eat anything you can get your hands on in Italy and France for 3 months. That sounds like a good gig, right? I mean, who wouldn't want that job? I get to eat my way through Italy and France. Awesome. But the end result was, you know, rashes on the inside of his thighs. He had trouble sitting up and getting from sitting to standing. He had trouble tying his shoes. He had high blood pressure. He started snoring. He would get fatigued more easily so that the shooting days had to be shorter. I mean, it had a real serious effect on him and his metabolism.
So that role had a really big effect. I think a lot of actors, like more and more actors, started like gaining weight or losing weight or, you know, doing something to their body to better understand or better portray or better look like the character that they were playing. And De Niro isn't the only person who had some kind of physical problem as a result. What impact do you think that's had? I mean, in the past, actors didn't do that earlier in acting history.
I think acting had been building towards that in a while, but it also, you cannot overstate the influence of Raging Bull. It is probably the most influential male American acting performance on film after Streetcar and On the Waterfront, right? You know, but part of the problem that actors steeped in the method were having on set is, how do I turn it on command, right? Because, you know, like, they've got to set the lighting, they got to do this, they got to stand you on your mark, and then suddenly someone calls action and you have to really be in character. Well, one way to solve that problem is to never break character, right? One way to solve that problem is to really live as the character as much as possible. That is not what Strasberg taught. Strasberg was actually very opposed to that. But particularly after Raging Bull, because De Niro wins the Best Actor Oscar for it, and from that point on, De Niro is sort of enshrined as our greatest living American film actor. It just exerts an enormous influence, not only on actors, but on the PR and awards campaigns for acting. And
oh,
so that
yes.
exerts
uh-huh.
its own influence, right? And so there becomes a kind of material or industrial reason why actors are doing this, because then they can talk about the fact that they did it. And that leads to the kind of, there's a self-parody kind of version of this. You know, we've all watched the press junkets where someone's like, oh yes, then I didn't bathe for 6 months and I got so drunk every night I vomited on myself. And so, you know, that's what I did to get into character. And it just seems ridiculous. That to me is a kind of perversion of what De Niro was trying to do.
I want to end with a quote from Lee Strasberg that you use in the book. He said, "The profession of acting, the basic art of acting, is a monstrous thing because it does with the same flesh and blood muscles with which you perform ordinary deeds, real deeds. The body with which you make real love is the same body with which you make fictitious love with someone you don't like. In no other art do you have this monstrous thing." That really reminds me of what a lot of actors have been telling me on our show, which is that your body doesn't know the difference between acting and real life. So when you put yourself through something horrible for a role, your body doesn't know that you're just acting.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the body keeps the score, right? That's the thing we're saying more and more these days. Yeah, your body does not know that you're acting, and your body is not as separate from your psyche as we like to model it. You know, they're not really that separated. Actually, part of why Stanislavski had such a pioneering idea of acting is that he didn't view those two things as separate. He viewed them as one interrelated mechanism, and they are. And as I learned in my own life experience, you know, the body chain smoking during talk radio was the body who felt like he was going to throw up for hours afterwards. That acting is a difficult and physical art form because the actor is their own material, and figuring out how you protect yourself within that, figuring out how you both do the job and remain a whole healthy human being is one of the particular challenges of being an actor. I was not up for it as a human being. I just knew I couldn't take it. And because of that, perhaps I am always admiring of anyone who can do it. I just think it's remarkable. And you know, the things that actors do so that we can be entertained or see some inner truth about our own lives. I'm very moved by that.
Well, Isaac Butler, thank you so much for talking with us. It was really, really interesting. I really appreciate it.
This was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Terry.
Isaac Butler is the author of the new book, The Method. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.